Hello, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to Countercurrents Radio. This is your host, Matthew Heimbach, and I'm being joined on the line by my good friend and comrade, Scott Terry. So we're here today to talk about a few things. First of all, the H.L. Mencken Club, which myself and other members of the Towson University White Student Union attended this past weekend, and Mr. Terry also attended, and the large drive we see in the calls for secession over the past week since the re-election of President Barack Obama, and a few other things we want to probably touch on will be the changing demographics and what that means for the Republican Party and white advocacy, and where do we go from here? So, Scott, thanks for being here. I appreciate it.
No problem. Good to be here.
So, Scott, why don't we just start off by tell us all what you thought of the conference and the speeches and the camaraderie. What were your impressions?
Hey, it's a really exciting time to be in the alternative right movement right now, in my opinion. This conference was a case in point. I mean, the speakers, you know, they're great. They're always great. I mean, they're top of the line. It's the H.L. Mencken Club, and we had some of the best professors and historians in the country come and talk. But the best part of it, I think, was just rubbing elbows with everybody and, you know, just getting a feel for how the currents of thought in the alternative right movement are, you know, moving around out there and just talking with people and networking. It's a good time. It was fun.
Fantastic. Fantastic. Now, what was your, who was your favorite speaker or specific topic that you enjoyed the most?
Gosh, you know, it would have to be, Professor Kenneth McIntyre, although it's a tie between, I mean, gosh, that's not really a fair question, Heimbach. You know, it would have to be McIntyre, although I love Derbyshire because Derbyshire is always very fun to listen to. Jared Taylor was awesome, as usual. Paul Gottfried was very interesting. But I'd have to say it was Dr. Kenneth McIntyre. He gave a talk on history as a serious discipline, and obviously my – you know, I'm more interested in philosophy and stuff than the actual history. So I kind of got into his lecture, but, I guess it all depends on, you know, what your background is and what you're going there to get. But, yeah, Mr. McIntyre was probably my favorite.
Excellent. Well, I think my one was the speech about Francisco Franco. And it was very interesting that it's a topic you usually don't hear about much in America, but the Spanish Civil War, I mean, it was covered to a pretty strong degree, and I think finally Franco and, you know, the regime that he led is, at least in my opinion, a model that we're going to need to look at as members of the alternative right, because you see in the resistance to communism and leftism and other outside foreign influences, the coalition between devout Catholics and other Christian groups, the monarchists, traditionalists, the groups like the Falangists, that I think that's in a stage in our movement where in terms of organization we should be looking towards Spain. So it was great to be able to hear that speech. But so what do you think after this conference, Scott? Where do you think we're going from here as members of the alternative or dissident right, you know, snipping at the heels of the communist establishment?
Well, I think you've put it in really good terms. I think it's really hard even at this point to define the movement. I mean, what do we call ourselves? Are we an alternative right? Are we the dissident right? Are we the, is it nationalism? Is it a nationalist movement? Is it a conservative? I mean, we don't know. I mean, I think there's a lot of factions vying for attention, and that's part of the reason why I think it's so exciting to be in this movement right now. And by the way, I say vying for position, but I don't want to make it sound like it's there's animosity between these factions, because I don't pick that vibe up. I think it's a very civil kind of thing, and there's a lot of camaraderie here. So I think that's one of the things Richard Spencer pointed out at the H.L. Mencken Club, is the club does a really good job at providing a forum for all these different dissident voices to kind of speak and collide, and God only knows what's going to come out of the collision, but it's going to be something crazy, and I'm looking forward to it.
No, I totally agree. I mean, looking at, it seems in America the biggest problem we've had on the right is the constant infighting of, if you're not right enough for me, or if you you believe in something just a little bit different, we might agree on 99% of the things, but, you know, instead of going after the communists or the leftists or good, I mean, even the Republicans, that we're going to go and, you know, be slitting the throats of, you know, our fellow brothers in arms who are trying to essentially shake up and overthrow the system. So I completely agree with you. My question is that, you know, I'm asking myself, and I don't really know the answer to, is how do we bring all these groups together? Because on one hand, we have the, I don't know if we want to call them extreme right, but we have people that are in groups that they might mean well, but they're not exactly working towards something productive, if you know what I mean. And playing dress up is not the way that we're going to, you know, save our people. So we've got that. We've got the intellectuals, like the folks we saw speaking today. We've got just everyday blue collar Americans who are coal miners or truck drivers or, you know, just trying to take care of their families. So we've got this very wide coalition, this very large base. And I'm not sure how, what the rally point is going to be, because it doesn't seem that we have many great leaders that are specialists in their field, but we're not having someone who has distinguished himself or herself as the undisputed leader of the American right. Like, I mean, like you have in Europe, for instance, you know, Marine Le Pen in France, you have, you know, Straka in Austria, you have Geert Wilders, you have specific people that control the dialogue and focus the energies of the various groups and unite all the different factions. And we just haven't been able to have that here. It's almost, you know, we have too many chiefs and too few Indians. So Scott, what do you think in terms of moving towards having a united front? Because as we see with the left, I mean, I've been to protests where I'm, you know, going against Sharia law, and because I'm fighting for women's rights and basic human rights, then the gays and the women, feminists and the communists and the Muslims all come together to attack me, even though realistically their ideologies call for exterminating one another, but they're able to come around and rally together. So it seems that we have much more in common than most people, obviously, because we're already, you know, hardcore right wing. What do you think the future is in terms of, I mean, is there a leader you see in the up and coming pack of, you know, the right wing movement that you think could take over that position? Or do you think we need to do something different? How do we go from being essentially guerrilla cells fighting, you know, this huge monstrosity against us into being an effective fighting force?
Sure. Well, I'm hearing a lot of things about this crazy guy coming out of Towson University of Maryland. You know, I'm not quite sure how that's going to turn out, but it seems like he might be, might have a little bit of promise when it comes to leading the white nationalist movement. But, you know, and there's a sense in which we're our own worst enemy, in my opinion. I mean, I'm just a farm boy from North Carolina, but it seems to me, if I could put it this way, that our, let's just call it the alternative right. It seems the alternative right is fractured in a very fundamental way right now. And this is a gripe I have, you know, over and over. And it's not just me. It's a lot of the intellectuals that have influenced me, the Southern agrarians, Donald Davidson especially. They talk about this fracturing in the psyche of right-wing movements. And, you know, I think until we overcome this sort of fracturing, which I could expound on if you'd like, but I think until we overcome that sort of fracturing in our movement, until we find some sort of unifying force, I don't want to say a religious force because I know that's going to send a lot of people running and it'll turn their ears off from me, but I think we need to find that one, I guess a folk poet of our people, you know, and he'll bring together the underlying dispositions of all our folks so that we'll be just as passionate as the enemies of our people who you talk about banded up against you and who we've all had the experience of dealing with. They all have the same underlying almost religious zeal for destroying everything I care about and everything you care about. So we need that same sort of passion underlying our movement. And I don't think we're going to get that until we got some kind of dynamic, poetic underpinning to the movement.
I totally agree with you, Scott. And as much as I appreciate the nomination as the future leader of the alternative right, I'm just I'm a farm boy from rural Maryland. So, you know, who knows where that's going to go, but I appreciate that vote of confidence.
Yeah.
but I agree. And I think the problem is there's just so many different factions. I mean, like you were touching on, and we are truly our worst enemies. You know, the very idea that you've got, you know, a Christian fundamentalist and someone who's following the folk traditions I mean, I've seen more than one time where the pagan will say that, you know, a true right winger will not follow that Jew God. And I mean, I've seen blows exchanged at events. And I mean, the idea that there are literally people out there right now who, you know, in terms of the federal government, who are probably listening in on this conversation, and, you know, they're watching us. They literally have kill lists and they have camps that they want to throw us into. And the president's talking about taking away our assault weapons and doing international treaties to limit the Second Amendment. And like, we think our biggest problem is where you go to church on Sunday morning. It just seems a little bit big to me. But one issue I found, and I want to know your opinion on it, is in regards especially to the religion issue. Now, I come at everything from as being a devout Christian. I come at everything, and the reason my worldview is what it is I see it through a Christian lens. And my actions and my conduct are because I'm a Christian. You know, it's not that I'm personally not right wing and a Christian. I'm right wing because I'm a Christian. And I think if you look truly towards, you know, history, especially some of the great authors we were talking about this weekend, that, you know, true, if you want to call it real conservatism, real, you know, pushback against this, the leftist, egalitarian, you know, socialist agenda, you know, it has been in the West based in Christianity. So that's the driving force that gets me up in the morning. So how do we as a movement, I mean, should we move towards being a more expressly Christian movement? I mean, like in the League of the South, there is no religious requirement to join, but is the acknowledgement that the South is a, you know, essentially a white Christian nation. Do we move more explicitly religious and more of a true fundamentalist, you know, devout Orthodox, St. Pius X Catholic, High Church Protestant, you know, that rejects the liberalization of the Christian Church, or do we move towards a more secular and just kind of try and put that on the back burner? What do you think in terms of that?
That's a big question, but I guess I'm unashamedly a Christian when it comes to these things. Like you said, I hold all my positions because of my faith, and I can't get around that. But I think there's something practical that Christianity can bring to the alternative right movement, and I want to go back to something that Richard Spencer said at the H.L. Mencken Club this weekend, and he recognized the fact that conservatism, as we know it in America, the Russell Kirk type of conservatism, and especially the neoconservatism, the conservatism as we know it in America is simply not working. It's simply not something that we can take seriously. We have to restructure our entire philosophy, as it were. I mean, that's an ambiguous term in this context, I know, but and I can't recall, I'm sorry, exactly what Spencer said word for word, but he did say, We have to have something new, a robust sort of thing. And I don't think we can base a new movement on any sort of pragmatic theories of knowledge, any sort of nihilistic pragmatism that's so popular among many in the white national circles right now. I think that's a self-refuting philosophy, and on a philosophical level anyway, I think we as Christians can offer something much more superior. And I think that's where we have to engage a lot more than we do. Now, me particularly, I come to all this from the standpoint of what's called kinism right now. And kinism, to put it in context for people, it's kind of a white nationalism from a uniquely evangelical perspective. And, you know, we have a strong dose of agrarianism, a strong dose of traditionalism, and it's sort of like a poetic white nationalism, if I could put it that way. But so I'm really, you know, we talk about the different factions under the alternative right tent, but I hope to really promote this kinism, because I think it's nothing less than the Christianity of the great writers of our past. I mean, if hell is the England of Dickens and Jane Austen and Sir Walter Scott, then consign me to the seventh level of it. That's what I tell people. Because I don't want to live anywhere else.
No, I totally agree. As a great Southern poet once said that, if heaven ain't a lot like Dixie, I don't want to go.
yes.
But, one thing that just very, very much strikes me, I mean, it also goes to my first show on Countercurrents that, you know, my talking about Christianity, I don't think I was that explicit about it, but, you know, I was told that I have a Christian fetish, which, like yourself, Scott, I'm not going to apologize about my faith, and I do think it is the right faith, but at the same time, I'm not trying to purposely attack folks, and it seems to me in the alternative right movement, it's almost like we're looking for reasons to fight one another. And the one thing I think the Europeans have figured out is, you know, you have political leaders like Geert Wilders, who himself is not a Christian, but acknowledges that Christianity, you know, is the backbone of the West and its traditions and its morals, its code of honor and chivalry. You know, at the very least, even if you don't believe that Christ has, you know, saved you from your sin, then you can at least appreciate what Christianity has given us. You know, the battle cry of, you know, Charles Martel and his men that repelled the Muslims in 732 was, you know, they were doing it because they were Christians in, you know, rejecting an invading army. You know, that was Islamic. That wasn't just because they were invading an army. It was a deeply fundamental difference that they were an Islamic army, you know, because Christians have been battling each other forever, but the ferocity in which the Franks fought, I think, was key. Having that, you know, besides our folk traditions and besides our blood, that extra push of faith really is what drives Europeans towards excellence, at least in my opinion. So, do you think that we should be, though, under, you know, a banner of a certain church, or do you think it should be a generic Christianity, or what are your thoughts in terms of that?
Well, you know, when we die, we all become Presbyterians anyway. So why not go ahead and, you know, honestly, that's a serious question. And I'd like to comment on something you said before I answer that, because I have a practical example of this infighting. You know, I was hanging out with some white nationalist buddies and I ordered a beer, you know, I ordered a Budweiser and my buddy says, Hey, you can't drink that. The Budweiser supports the Negro College Fund, you know? And so I said, well, all right, let me order something else. So I said, well, let me get a Corona. And he said, whoa, hold on. You can't drink that. That's from, south of the border. You know, Mexicans make that. I mean, you know, and I'm at the point now where it's like, really, I can't drink a beer because there's, you know, we're harping on these things. So I ended up ordering a Sam Adams, and I guess that was okay. Although I'm...
Hey, that's a Yankee beer.
Yeah, that's a Yankee beer, so I'm damn there, too. Don't tell any of my Southern buddies I drink Sam Adams. You know, the problem is, it's like you said, we're a dissident movement. And when you're a dissident movement, by definition, you're rejecting social mores. And you're trying to find and reestablish a sort of set of social norms among yourselves, and everybody does it in his own way. And me personally, I look to the literature of the past. Sir Walter Scott especially has influenced me. The blog Cambria Will Not Yield, I don't know if anybody, I'm sure people in your audience are familiar with Cambria Will Not Yield. That blog has influenced me so much. These people like that, they reiterate the old European social norms that our people used to adhere to, especially chivalry and the laws of chivalry. And something I think chivalry instead of a specific Christian denomination, you know, I think chivalry is a set of ethics that are unique to our people. They're unique in the world. And I think it's something we could get back into. There's still a sort of a folk infatuation with this. If you talk about chivalry to a high school kid, he might be like, oh yeah, I kind of have a somewhat of a notion of it. It's not something that's going to divide people. Although it does have the potential to be explosive, but you know, chivalry has a way to deal with that as well. It's called dueling. And I think we need to bring that back. And it would, anyway, that, so instead of, you know, Catholic, Protestant, Presbyterian, Methodist, what are we going to do? I just think we need to adhere to something like bring back a chivalrous mindset, and then we can let the theologians figure out what kind of church they want to build.
Excellent. Well, on that note, we're going to take a real quick break. So ladies and gentlemen, stick with us and we'll be right back. Awesome. All right, ladies and gentlemen, well, thank you so much for coming back with us. It's Matthew Heimbach and Scott Terry, members of the Young Dissident Right, hopefully bringing a revolution to you sometime soon. So one of the topics we've been discussing is morals and chivalry and the role of Christianity. And one thing I really wanted to touch on is an issue I've had in our movement for a while that you see in books like the Turner Diaries and some speeches given by more impassioned members of our movement, the idea that once we create a homeland for our people, for the European race, then we need to march and go onwards and upwards towards eradicating every other single group of people on the planet. And then, of course, we're probably going to have to do something about those redheads and the Irish, or, you know, my people are Germans, so probably have to go after us too. But, you know, it's this problem that I feel that, one, first of all, I feel that is horribly immoral, because any sort of conflict we would have, I would hope that as Christians and majority Christian nations, we would use just war doctrine to determine the treatment of civilians, of combatants, of the idea that this is not out to subjugate anyone or hurt anyone. It's about preserving our people and our culture and our heritage and our race. So, one, it's just bothered me for a long time, the idea that, you know, we'd be sending kids, you know, 18, 19 years old for two, three centuries, possibly, going to the ends of the earth to eradicate people, you know, just because we don't like them, even when they're not bothering us. So that is a gripe I've had, because I think that one, is immoral. Two, turns off a large percentage of the white population, because your average white American or even European, really, if they're in our circle, what they want first and foremost is they have obedience to God, to their family, and then to our people. So I think it turns a lot of people off. When it's not about preservation, it then becomes a war of conquest. And my next point is that it's one, not feasible. I mean, you think we'd have to nuke 3/4 of the planet? That just gets to ridiculous lengths. So, Scott, I want to ask your opinion in terms of, I'm sure you've heard these conversations, read books in which people have discussed this idea of it's going to be a white-only world. So what do you think in terms of the position that people have taken in the movement on this? And if you disagree with it, how we can try and remedy that? And if you agree with it, well, then I'll start praying for you.
Oh, that's bad, because I was going to say I do kind of agree with it in an attenuated sense, but maybe not in the way these guys mean it that you might have been referring to, because I have, like you said, I have heard that same sort of rhetoric throughout the blog forums and alternative right, you know, web forums all over the net. I do think that this goes back. Let me begin my response by saying this. This goes back to the underlying fracturing within the movement anyway. Mm-hmm. I mean, are you going to be a Christian? Are you going to be there's various ways you can slice the pie up. I've heard people slice it up various different ways. Libertarians, you know, you've got the libertarians, you've got the Christians, you've got the traditionalists, you've got the pagans, you've got the hardcore human biodiversity, eugenicists. It goes on and on, and the categories blend together. I'm a Christian, and that means I have some sort of robust eschatology, which is a fancy word for a theory of end time things. And so my theory of eschatology is called post-millennialism. Mm-hmm. And this is a very minority view, even among Presbyterians like myself, but basically, we believe that the church is eventually going to be victorious over the entire world. And the church, to me, the Christian movement is defined in a large part by white European culture. And so I see that in people in the Kenist movement. And by the way, I'm not speaking for all Kenists when I say this. I'm kind of a wacko here, but I think what this means is going to be some sort of robust imperialism, and but it's going to be almost utopian. But if I could speak really frankly, and people can call me naive for this, I think God created all the races for their own continent. I mean, we've all heard the mantra, right? The Bob Whitaker's mantra, Africa for the Africans, Asia for the Asians, and white countries for everybody. Right. Well, I think there's a certain extent where Africa is for the Africans and Asia is for the Asians, and you know, Europe and America and are for whites. And but I think it has to be within a Christian European cultural context. So, you know, I don't buy this notion that, you know, blacks in Africa beating on drums can worship God just like I can. You know, I think they have to be civilized and suit and tie wearing, you know, with an ethics and preferably some sort of code of chivalry down there before I'll be ready to say that, hey, they're Christian now. But I know that was a convoluted answer, but there it is, you know.
That's no, I mean, Scott, I agree with a lot of what you said. And I mean, the thing that I've always seen, I've always been a colonialist myself, that, I mean, I think if I could get my perfect way, would be living under European Christian monarchies, and the colonial system would still be in effect, because I've actually spoken with plenty of blacks who come from post-colonial areas in Africa, and the one thing I always hear is the same, I wish the white man was still there. Like, I really wish you guys hadn't have left. Like, you shouldn't have listened to the communists.
Detroit too, so.
Oh, exactly. Oh, try and go to Atlanta. No offense to my comrades in Georgia, but I mean, I think what the best system would be once we've kind of gotten our own space is, I mean, colonialism, when it looks what European Christian civilization brings, it's not only churches, it's infrastructure, it's schools, it's medicine. I mean, curing things like polio is kind of nice. You know, malaria, anti-malaria drugs, food were really good. I mean, Zimbabwe is finding out, you know, Rhodesia was the breadbasket of Africa, and now when it's under black rule, they're starving and on UN food drops. So it seems like one of those situations in which I totally agree that as European Christians, our duty also, I think, is to enlighten the lesser groups and to, you know, we might get some economic benefit, but it lifts them up too. But we still need to be firm at a strong dividing line that our countries are for us. Europe is for us, but that doesn't mean that we're going to, you know, be hoarding all of the wealth of the world, and we can try and lift them out of, like you said, beating on drums in, you know, South Sudan. Actually, more like North Sudan, because they're Muslims and have far less culture, and they do things like crucify cats. So, but I don't know. I mean, is that the sort of system you're thinking about, or am I just stuck in the 1800s?
Yeah, well, honestly, the evangelical movement in America is so, this is a technical term I'm going to use. It is so retarded right now that, there's not a lot of really good racially self-conscious work being done when it comes to evangelism and especially missions work. So we have to kind of look to the past and see what our ancestors did. And, I think I'm with you about the colonialism and the European monarchies and all that, which, by the way, if I could make a brief parenthetical comment, was a strong theme throughout this conference among many, many of the younger people. This is another divide that's taking place. You got the younger guys who are advocating for third way economic positions, who've been influenced by countercurrents, and British distributism of G.K. Chesterton and the like. And then you've got the older guys saying, you know, still wanting to hold to some form of civic nationalism. And that's a divide that I'm really glad to see taking place. The younger guys are like you and, Richard Spencer. These guys are moving in for these third way economic positions. But to the main point, I think you were right there. There's a lot that we're going to have to feel out and a lot that we're going to have to forge, a lot of ground we're going to have to forge here. And I personally, I'm going to leave that to whoever has a missionary spirit, because frankly, I do not feel like walking through Africa with a Bible, you know? Not at this point in the game.
No, I understand. And we have a whole heck of a lot of work to do here. The thing that always breaks heart to hear about is the idea that, you know, the Africans are sending us missionaries now, that instead of us doing the work, over there, they're, that actually our Christian spirit has been so destroyed, just demoralized, especially in Europe, that places like South Korea and stuff are sending missionaries to us because they are, you know, they're essentially more Christian than we are in some ways. And I think that's a true problem we need to get to. But, in terms of the third wave and the generational gap, I think is very interesting because, you and I were both at the Council of Conservative Citizens, conference this, this past summer. And the one thing, I mean, I about developed a drinking problem listening to some of those speeches because, you know, talking about, you know, how they're encouraged us to vote for Mitt Romney, first of all. And oh my God, I about had a heart attack. But secondly, one of the things that hugely just upset me is the idea of taking America back. That it seems, especially of the older generation, you know, that worked on the George Wallace campaigns, was in the White Citizens Council, you know, especially in the South, I think that's one of our biggest problems, especially considering how many of our people are veterans that were almost shackled to Uncle Sam's plantation based on the idea we can take America back. Capitalism, you know, unrestrained capitalism is a great idea. We just need to tweak it a little bit and we're going to return to Beaver Cleaverville sometime next week. It just takes a little bit of elbow grease and, you know, it's the Black's fault or it's somebody else's fault, but we're about to win, so it's all right. So how do you, and that's no meant to insult because I am a CFCC member. I'm very active in the Baltimore area with my chapter, but it's, you know, at the conference, I was just very disturbed by some of the speeches I was hearing and we're talking with folks after hours and at this conference and just in my everyday life that there just is this huge, huge generational gap where it's different ideologies, but also people of our, generation are much more militant, I feel. I mean, I was talking with some people at the H.L. Mencken conference and they were like, look, we at some point are going to have to revert to being an IRA sort of presence if we're going to not be exterminated. And I was like, well, I'm not going to give a comment on that because you might be a Fed, but silence is a mild form of consent. So it just seems that there's this huge generational gap in terms of ideology, in terms of activism. It seems like people of our generation are much more willing to go out there and be in the streets in a very much European style. So why do you think there's that generational gap and where do you think the alternative right movement is going? Are we as young folks going to be able to kind of Shanghai it and move it towards our ideology, or do you think we're going to be forced to kind of suffer and plod along with this pro-American brouhaha, you know, taking America back ideology?
Well, I, you know, to begin with here, talking about the rowdy youth in the alternative right movement, I heard rumors as I was leaving the conference this weekend that somebody urinated all over a Yankee van, a Yankee clubhouse. I'm not sure who that was, but I thought it was really, you know, there was some witnesses that said it was a ridiculously good looking, young, handsome white boy. But that's the sort of, activism we're going to start seeing. And by the way, we're being like this because you know what? We have to be. I specifically remember that conversation you were talking about with that old gentleman at the Council of Conservative Citizens Club, and you were trying to explain to him about fascism, and he would not hear any of it, and he at one point said, I was in the Wallace campaign. And you know, that conversation really struck out in my mind, because I saw before me this budding heads of the two generations. Our generation has to live with all the mistakes that they made, and we have to live with all the crap that their generation is putting down on us through their reliance on this civic nationalism, through their attempt to manipulate the democratic process that has failed miserably. We have to live with that. Mm-hmm. It's we're the ones and our children, and we're going to have all of our assets taken by the new majority in America. So I think there is going to be, and in fact, I hope you don't hate me for this, but I encourage radicalism. Uh-huh. Although, you know, I'm not going to comment on the extent to which I would encourage it, but, you know, I think that has to start being a viable option because honestly, the democratic process, as we've all just seen this past Tuesday, is definitely less and less of an option for us.
I totally agree. And, you know, it's the sort of thing where I'd think that, you know, as much as I respect Governor Wallace, you know, for his strong stance in many ways, that it I don't know, maybe it's just me. I'm becoming disillusioned that I look back now and I think about, you know, George Wallace as being a moderate, you know, with the people I hang out with. I mean, you know, you and I talk a great deal, but just it's not just a small group of crazies. It really is a wide spectrum within our movement, but especially amongst the young, where, you know, I've had many people say, and I totally agree, that George Wallace never should have moved out of those schoolhouse steps, and instead the Alabama National Guard should have either opened fire or at the least stood by their governor and refused to allow federal troops to forcibly integrate the school. So, I mean, do you think in terms of that position where we've just seen how this old way is failing, the going and campaigning and trying to get some votes, and maybe we'll elect a councilman one day who will think the way we do, that working within this democratic system is inherently biased against us? I mean, do you think, for instance, a stance of, you know, say Governor Wallace never moved out of those steps and it got into a more forcible confrontation, do you think that that would have been a better move for us as a people than him bowing and letting the Yankee government get what they wanted?
Well, it would have been a lot better for us poets if he would have stood there and fought. And this is something that I don't know the future. I can't say what's going to be good and what's not going to be good. All I know is I know who I am as a person. I know what my heart says, and I know that I'm going to go down fighting. And that's the sort of attitude we need to have. That's what we saw in Tolkien's Return of the King. You know, when the Riders of Rohan showed up, they knew they weren't going to win, but they believed, they had this faith, and they rode forth and they were true to themselves. That's what our attitude as a minority is going to have to be. And as long as there is one person who still believes in the God of our ancestors, I believe there's going to be hope, and that's all really that we're going to need in the end. And I know that's not a very practical sounding thing, but my mind isn't geared towards practicality. Like I said, I think we need to return to a underlying poetic disposition in our people so that we can regain our identity and regain a forceful attitude towards the world.
I agree, and that's you know, something that we've kind of touched on. In terms of the democratic process, though, and we've just got a little bit before we take a break, we'll probably expound upon a little bit more, but with this election of Barack Obama, and the word on everyone's lips is demographics. Demographics, demographics. You know, I run around with the Jared Taylor books and talk about racial demographics affecting elections. I've done this for years at this point. And, you know, I've never heard a pundit on any of the major networks discussing demographics 1/100th as much as I've heard in the past week. You know, if I'm glad it's a new buzzword, but the Republican Party has essentially conceded that it has become the party of whites, as it has been. You know, the Democrats were the party of whites until they decided they wanted the minority vote, and the Republicans stood up then, as you know, in the 1970s and, you know, late 60s, and started taking on the role of the white conservative party. But now we have both parties that are standing back and saying, well, I mean, we're kind of both going to do everything. You know, you're looking at representatives, as much as it hurts me, from, you know, the South, from South Carolina, I mean, discussing now amnesty to allow millions upon millions of these invaders, these criminals, these non-whites, to then be given amnesty. And where, you know, we need to pick Marco Rubio in 2016 for president, and how we need to be working with minorities, we need to, like, drop copies of Atlas Shrugged into, like, the ghetto, because obviously the reason blacks don't vote Republican is because they don't understand free market capitalism, and, like, drop pictures of Ronald Reagan in the barrio, and that's what's going to save the day. Instead of working towards getting the white vote, which is the only thing that seems to work, because I think, as we know as a people, that Europeans, you know, except for a few small outsiders, are the right wing. We are. We always have been. You know, the Japanese, but there's only a Japanese problem going on in America. It's an invasion of the third world, where if you look at their democratic elections, the question is, are they going to elect the communists or the socialists? It's not, the right wing is not in play. So what do you think is the future of the Republican Party? What do you think we do about these demographics? And how do we channel this? And I'll give you a second to think about that, because we're going to take our second break of the evening. So ladies and gentlemen, hold your breath. Mr. Scott Terry is going to be back with his response in just 1 minute. All right, ladies and gentlemen, well, thank you so much. So I know you all have been eagerly awaiting to know what Mr. Terry's thoughts are and what we're going to do as a movement, what the Republican Party's going to do, and how demographics is the buzzword for the day. So, Scott, what's your insight on the topic?
Well, I think we need to, and not just us as alternative rightists, but I think the mainstream Republican movement is going to seriously begin finding its way to us. As odd as that sounds, and we have something that the South Africans don't, for instance. We have a robust alternative right movement to begin with, and we've laid a fine structure here. So what's happening here, in my opinion, is, and I've gone to the CPAC, the Conservative Political Action Conference in D.C., and I try to walk around and get a feel for what's going on in mainstream Republicanism. And what really, Ron Paul is the name here that we really need to focus on here, because Ron Paul is changing the roots of the Conservative Party. And as these young punk kids at colleges, as they discover Ron Paul, as I did and as others in the alternative right movement did, they'll discover Austrian economic theory and the Mises Institute. And when they discover the Mises Institute, they're going to discover Hans Hoppe's Democracy, the God That Failed. They're going to start discovering these alternative right writers like Gary North. They might even come across Tom Sunak's Against Democracy and Equality, and they're going to start learning about these third way economic positions, and then that's just going to filter them right over to alternative right, Countercurrents, Occidental Observer, and all of that. So I think this. This election, this loss is going to be ultimately a good thing, hopefully, because I hope it ultimately funnels young white neocons into our movement. But that's a naive hope maybe that I have, but it's there.
Oh, I hate to sound like a broken record, but once again, I'm agreeing with you. I think, and one thing I wanted to touch on is the fact that now I'm looking at, on the White House's website, there is now 21 states who have entered, you know, members, the citizens of the states have entered calls for peaceful secession from the Union, and Texas has gotten more by thousands upon thousands of signatures of American citizens calling for the peaceful secession. So in terms of the loss and, you know, these neocons and the moderates coming right, the idea that secession now is also seemingly, at least on the table to a degree, is very interesting to me, and I'm very excited. I might be biased as a Southern nationalist, but that sort of thing gets me excited. I get excited when I hear about Lega Nord in Italy, or the Catalonia province in Spain talking about seceding, and in my own backyard having in 3 days, over 25,000 signatures for a petition for secession. I mean, it's like Christmas has come early. So do you think the secession movement is going to grow? Do you think we should be working towards that? And then once we're free of the federal empire, we can start making our own laws in terms of immigration, citizenship, things like that. Or do you think this is just a majority Southern reaction, harkening back to our ancestors, and we need to be pushing towards something different?
Well, it's hard to tell about movements like this. I'm not a history buff. Like I studied, philosophy and theology and stuff. I'm not very good at history, but I do know enough about Southern history to know that before the actual war between the states, there was talk of secession all over the place. I mean, from New York and all over. You have these secession movements. And so I think the more it happens, the more these petitions are brought before, which, by the way, is ludicrous. Our ancestors, our Southern ancestors would you know, balk at the idea of having to ask the federal government if we could have, you know, had polite, ask politely to have permission to leave, you know, really. But, it's encouraging in a degree, because if we get this notion into the popular mind and into the zeitgeist of society, as it were, then, I think it might have potential to blow up into something. But I honestly, my gut says that not much is going to come from these succession movements. But I don't know. Maybe I'm being cynical.
All right, Scott. So one real question in terms of, we've kind of touched along a lot of different things, and now I'm kind of having fantasies about Nathan Bedford Forrest being king of the South. Maybe we could find a way to clone him or something. But my question in terms of signs, that's one thing that's very important to our movement that there's not a lot of agreement on, and not signs like things we hold in our hands, but the symbols that will represent us. That, you know, I've had, my Lord, so many arguments with people over things. And I've said publicly before that things like Third Reich iconography needs to be done away with. It should have been done away with in 1945, and that's not meant to offend anyone. It's just the idea that you're not going to win anyone, because anyone who enjoys those symbols is already there. There's no moderate people walking around with Third Reich nationalist symbols that are just like confused. They're already hardcore right wing. So I just say flat out, we need to get rid of that. We need to get rid of a lot of things that we've kind of fallen and been trapped in the Western movement. So in terms of what flags, what symbols, like what banners do you think will be most effective in this day and age? Like, I personally, enjoy using the 13 star Betsy Ross flag, because that to me is kind of what the real America was supposed to be. You know, of course, Tea Party flags are great, the Gadsden flags. I prefer the black, more militant one, Live Free or Die. But I really haven't found something that struck me as the true symbol for our movement. So do you have any thoughts as to what banner we should be flying at our various rallies and such?
Well, I am not at all presumptuous enough to speak about what the entire movement ought to be doing. I'm doing good just to carve out a little place for myself in my corner of the world. But and on another note, I'm also a very passionate romantic. I tend to idealize the past, and I love my past. I love my history. I love my people, and I think this love that I have for them is what fuels my hatred for liberaldom. Mm-hmm. I mean, everything in liberaldom. And so I'm not so. I do happen to think there is one symbol in our past that is very, very, pardon the pun, inflammatory. And, I think that perhaps it's time in America again to start seeing this symbol on hilltops across the nation, and in backwoods parking lots, and, the symbol of our people, encapsulating who we are and our identity is the cross. And this is a very ancient symbol for us, and it is a very much a part of our psyche. And I love that. I think that is the ultimate call to arms. There's a Scottish song, I think it was originally sung by a man named Scottish folk singer Dougie MacLean. I've probably mispronounced his name. I apologize to any of my Scottish nationalist friends out there listening, but he talks about the fiery cross as a song, and it's not in an American Southern context, so it has no Klan overtones. It's in a very Scottish Highland context, and I think that really has an emotional impact on me personally. Whether it runs people off from the movement or whatever, I don't know. But I think there's strategic ways we could use that. And I'm not, call me a curmudgeon or a stick in the mud or whatever, but I'm not ready to give that up. It means so much to me. And I'm not, if people laugh and sneer at it, they're going to laugh and sneer anyway. I hate to speak in those stark terms, but I'm not too much a fan of those people, and they don't like me either. So, it is. That's where I have to come down on it. I'm not going to yield my heritage and my people and my religious tokens like that.
Oh, well, I mean, I think that perfectly makes sense, especially as Southerners. I mean, things like I'm actually sitting and staring at my Confederate battle flag that's on my wall. And that's the sort of thing where, you know, people talk about how, well, we could give up this because it offends, you know, it offends the blacks, it offends the liberals. And my response has always been, well, I really don't care, because if you didn't notice, my political ideology doesn't, they don't come into that. They don't really matter. So I'm not gonna put my battle flag down. I'm not gonna put down the symbols of the South. So no, I think that that's true. And I feel as a movement in America, especially in the American South, that symbols like that truly are a call to arms to us. That the you know, using symbols like, you know, Third Reich imagery, that's not an American symbol, you know, that's yes. A German symbol. So exactly. So as Americans, we should be going back to the true symbols of our ancestors and our kin, and then honoring those. And people don't like it. Well, like you said, they're probably really, really not going to like us anyway. So I totally agree.
Can I say something about that?
Of course.
This remember the first thing I said way back when we started the interview was talking about this fracturing of the psyche of our movement. And I think this directly speaks to that fracturing. What we have is we have a bunch of kids in America who have no real folk relation to the Third Reich. They don't understand. I mean, they at best, some of them might have read history, but what they're doing is they're taking this ideology that they have and they're trying to glamorize it. But they don't really, it's not something that's deep down bred in their bones. They don't know about it. And, so whether they're using Third Reich imagery, whether they're talking about evolution, whether they're talking about eugenics or whatever, it represents in my mind a fracturing of, in the psyches of these people that, you know, like Donald Davidson talks about, like various poets talk about, and I really think the imagery issue hits on that point. I feel very strongly, I mean, very strongly about a symbol of a lit cross when I see it. It's ingrained in my, who I am as a person. Now, I could march around dressed in a Third Reich outfit and I'm not necessarily, you know, don't anybody take this as I'm against the Third Reich or I'm, you know, I do have my criticisms of Hitler and everything, but I'm certainly a partial and a friendly critic, I hope. So I'm not putting down that. But I'm just saying that if it's not a organic part of who you are and part of your identity, then it's really presumptuous to march around in a Third Reich outfit. And I think that's in large part what the white nationalist movement and the alternative right movement at large is doing. They're trying to take on a new identity. I think when we have a perfectly good one already, that I'm not ready to give up.
No, I agree with you on that. I think we have, I hope one more time for enough for one more question. So in terms of, we talk a lot about Southern symbols, Southern identity, and the true divide, I think, as it has been for hundreds of years, is North versus South. That how do we, as a movement, or are we actually, is that something we're pushing for? That as a alternative right, white nationalist movement, whatever we are, again, we're still have to have a conference and pick the name, I guess. But, how do we solve the huge divide between North and South? Or is that something we just want to acknowledge as, well, we can have that white Christian country up there and a white Christian country down here. Because, I mean, I'll tell you what, I've visited plenty of northern states. There are so many great people, salt of the earth. I mean, you know, I hang out in western Pennsylvania, for instance, in coal country, and that, it's almost like being at home. You know, they're great people. So don't take this as me insulting the North. I have my, you know, my anger about the war between the states, but modern day Northerners, I'd say the vast majority are great people. So,
but it's still, we're different. We're a different culture. We have a different bloodline. There's just a huge divide. So how do we settle this North versus South conflict? Or is that something that we're just going to have to accept and work parallel to one another?
Well, you know, anything north of Virginia is Canada, as far as I'm concerned.
You want to say that again?
I would never say that in your presence, because I'm not a fast enough runner, I don't think.
You'd only die tired, my friend.
Yeah. I think in a large part, the distinctives of the South were really based on the land and agriculture. And after the Industrial Revolution, in our age right now, I think, especially with the internet, especially with the advent of the internet, cultures are being kind of homogenized to an extent, and we don't have as strong a regional divide as we did. Nevertheless, I do think, and I'm not an economist, obviously, but I do think maybe there could be some regional interests that we still might have. And I have been very much influenced by the Southern agrarians, the fugitive poets, Donald Davidson, as I've mentioned, Stark Young, John Crow Ransom is another one. These guys, I think the manifesto here is their book, I'll Take My Stand, by the 12 Southerners. And they really hit this idea up of industrialism, modernism. And I keep going back to Donald Davidson because I love him. He's the most consistent Southerner. He feels with his whole heart. I mean, I love this guy. He's a huge influence on me. And he's got a book called Still Rebels, Still Yankees, in which he talks about the very question you've raised. How is the South to proceed? Basically, that's the question. And he talks about it in terms of the literary tradition of the South versus the literary traditions in the North. And by the way, I had Davidson in mind quite a bit during the H.L. Mencken conference, because as anybody who's familiar with Mencken knows, he was not particularly friendly to the South.
And that is true.
Jared Taylor did a very good job, I think, in covering Mencken. Taylor, of course, was the special guest speaker, and how often in our lives are we going to get to hear the Jared Taylor provide a lecture on the H.L. Mencken? You know, it was just awesome. But he did a good job, Mr. Taylor did, of pointing out that even though Mencken had a really low view of the South, he didn't necessarily have a low view of the antebellum South. Just the South, you know, post-war, that was basically devoid of culture. But I had that in mind this weekend at the conference. I had Donald Davidson in mind this weekend at the conference when we were hearing about H.L. Mencken, because Davidson does have his criticisms of Mencken. He kind of hits back, I suppose, in various ways. And the ideal here is that the South has a distinct tradition of feeling with our whole hearts. We're connected to the land still. Rural Southern Americans, and really rural whites all over the place. You have, you know, Robert Frost in the North would be a poet that represents this same idea in the North among rural whites. But the idea is we're wedded to the land. This makes us better people. This makes us whole people. We're not fractured. We don't have this fractured psyche. So that's gonna mean that we always have the potential to write better fiction, to live better lives, and to take on the world in a more vibrant and creative way that I really think God has meant for us to take on the world. And by the way, these agrarian ideals are actually gaining in popularity right now through organic food movements, back to the earth movements. You're seeing hippie kids on organic farms and moving back to nature. So I think the South is rising again, just like, you know, seeds rise from the earth, literally at this point. A return to agriculture it's a very exciting time, and I can't say what's going to become of it, but for me, I'm very optimistic about that.
Fantastic. Well, Scott, I appreciate so much you being with me, and I appreciate everybody listening in. I look forward to hopefully having you again on the show, because I can guarantee we probably got a couple years worth of material the two of us could jab our jaws about. But thank you, ladies and gentlemen, for listening to Countercurrents Radio, and I hope to see you next time.